Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Snark is not a pretty thing, but the New Yorker film critic David Demby decided that we should talk about this cultural phenomenon anyway because he thinks that we're better than the snark that seems to have cornered the market on public discourse. David wrote a book about it, Snark. It's mean, it's personal, and it's ruining our conversation, and he's with us today to talk about it. Welcome to the show, David.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
What is snark? I know what it is in kind of at a gut level, but didn't really know it literally until I read your book.
Well, it's my tag for a certain kind of mean, personal, nasty, rug-pulling, finger-pointing, undermining sarcasm in public speech. I want to distinguish it from hate speech, mm-hmm. which is directed at groups. But you see a lot of it in political discourse. You hear a lot of it on the internet. People slander their neighbors and then don't sign their name to web posts. You know, it's all over the place, and partly it's because of the internet and many other things, but partly because of the anxieties of our time, both in journalism and economically. But it does seem, everyone wants to be a comic, and it's hard being a comic. You can imagine how mm-hmm. many stupid lines that Jay Leno or Jon Stewart throws out every day before they actually come up with the ones that they want to use on the air. So it's all over the place, and it's not doing our political discourse any good.
You say that it's not, you distinguish it from hate speech because it's not aimed at a group, but a lot of snark is subliminally aimed at a group. I think you write that snark is used to appeal to prejudice by coding racism as a joke that at the conscious level hides what's being said. The listener's unconscious then does the dirty work, making the connection the snarker wants him to make.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of that during the campaign aimed at Barack Obama. And all this harping on, how he was allegedly a Muslim and not, even though he's been a Christian since birth, was a way of sort of otherizing him, saying he's different from you and me, and Sarah Palin saying he was palling around with terrorists, that kind of thing. I mean, it was a way of saying he's black, and you don't want to trust him without saying those words explicitly. And I think it's still going on. And I'm depressed by how many people in the Republican Party are without having great ideas of their own and just trying to destroy the president. And I think they are relying on a kind of backstairs prejudice, which they want to evoke any way they can without actually using the words. So just what you said, there's a kind of coded racism that takes place, in all kinds of nasty cracks. So that can be pretty ugly.
Talk about the origins of snark, because they're very dark. And I mentioned early at the top of the hour that I tried to use the word in a story one day when I worked for a newspaper, and they wouldn't let me. They said it's not really a word. And you've certainly validated me as a user of words.
Well,
so where does it come from?
Lewis Carroll, the writer of Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass, wrote this nonsense poem, The Hunting of the Snark, in the 1870s. And he thought he made up the word. I mean, the snark is a mythical beast. But there were such words around in some of the northern European languages like German and Danish and Swedish and so on. Snark and snork and so on. It meant to snore or to snort. It was, for Carroll, just a wonderful sounding word. And by degrees, it evolved into its current usage, which means to rag at someone in a personal way. By about 1905, people in England were beginning to use it that way. Now that the phenomenon has grown, the word is beginning to grow also as a tag for a certain kind of low, nasty speech. But as a practice, it's eternal. Since, of course, malice is as natural to the human heart as kindness. And I just want to say parenthetically, you'd have to be inhuman not to snark our former governor here in New York, Elliot Spitzer, who was sleeping with $4,500 hookers after prosecuting the vice business,
mm-hmm.
Or Dick Cheney shooting his best friend in the face. How could you be human and not come up with 50 jokes about that? But yeah, there were Greek drinking clubs in Athens. You know, the aristocrats would get together, let's say way back in the 8th century BC, and one person in this sort of protected group would take, as we would say, the persona of a low-born Athenian and make fun of someone within the room, making fun of his drinking habits, his sexual habits. You can imagine the nature of this fun. It was pretty rough stuff, but it was considered okay because it was within a club. And then it went out into the public space in Greece where there were...
In performance, right?
Yeah, poets declaiming invective, you know, in public squares or posting their verses, on a pole somewhere, and some of these people who practiced this even boasted that their victims were so ashamed that they hanged themselves. So, and in Rome, it was considered an absolutely okay part of rhetoric in the Senate to make fun of your opponent's sexual habits, and so on. So, it's gone high and low. I mean, in the 18th century, this kind of really nasty stuff was practiced at a very high literary level by Jonathan Swift and Alexander Pope. Tons of it in American pamphlet discourse during the Revolution and the 19th century, but what we're getting now is, I think, not at that level of literary inventiveness. And I would give anything a pass that creates language in some way, that fresh metaphor, even a fresh physical description, seems to me, you know, an effort that you reward with pleasure. But there's a lot of just sort of lazy... picking up junk stuff off the junk heap of the media, an available joke, and just giving it a tiny little twist, and it's not just aimed at politicians and celebrities. It's aimed at all of us. Your neighbor can go on the web, and that doesn't like you, a rival, a business rival, or someone who wants your seat on the school board or something.
Mm-hmm.
And take you down anonymously and never bear any consequences of it, whereas before you had to confront someone. And it doesn't go away. I mean, it might have earlier gone into a newspaper and then yellowed in the local library, but now it's you can Google it up forever. Or some guy sleeps with a girl at college and gets on one of these campus sites and takes her apart physically. In a very intimate and unpleasant way, and what we would have called caddish behavior, mm-hmm. 50 years ago. And she might laugh it off, but she goes for a job interview 10 years later. It's gonna Google up when someone who might hire her, checks her references. That's no joke. I mean, there are a lot of law professors now worried about the total lack of privacy we have on the Internet.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Denby. He is New Yorker film critic and an author. He's written two other books, great books, and also American Sucker, his latest, Snark. It's mean, it's personal, and it's ruining our conversation. I think that personal part, there was a definition you gave of it after talking about Lewis Carroll's poem. You said the snark is the thing that makes you disappear.
Yeah.
And that was really creepy to me.
Yeah, at the end of the poem, the people who go in search of the mythical beast, the snark, someone finds one and immediately he disappears.
But it's sort of like an allegory, I don't know, for dehumanization.
Yeah. Yeah, really snarky people want their enemies to be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
They want them to disappear. It's true. I'm going to be partisan here. I think the Republicans really trying to destroy Obama's presidency without having good ideas for health reform or stimulus themselves is an example of wanting your enemy to disappear. I mean, and it's malicious and not very useful, putting it mildly. So, I don't mean to say that it's all coming from the right towards the left. There is certainly liberal snark also. There's plenty of it on MSNBC. There's, I mean, Paul Begala, one of Clinton's strategy advisors, is a master of it. The people, I'm not crazy about Sarah Palin, but people who anonymously attacked her after the election was over, the people within the McCain campaign staff, anonymously saying she was a diva and she was out of control and all of that. I mean, mm-hmm. I thought that was pretty low. I mean, if you're going to attack someone, sign your name to it.
It's kind of interesting. Well, that is another element to it. But you've accused her of snark. She's a victim of snark.
Right, both ways.
All's fair and snark.
Yeah, I mean, right. It's total combat. I mean, you know, and her intimating that Obama was some sort of terrorist or something because he was palling around. You know, he had served on the same boards in Chicago 20 years earlier with a guy, you know, who was an SDSer and a kind of left-wing guy. I mean, it was a very tenuous connection. That was, as I said, that may have been a kind of coded way of saying this guy is different. He's not like you and me. And she's also been the victim of a lot of it. As I say, I don't like her, but I think, you know, and I don't like the teabaggers either, but I think what the feelings they have are absolutely genuine, the feeling of loss and that they've been given the short end of the stick in some way. That is something I entirely sympathize with. And, I mean, I don't like their signs and their language and their rhetoric and their loathing of Obama and all of that seems to me completely unfair. But what they're feeling, what's producing that anguish is something that is respected and dealt with and seriously dealt with. And I don't know that the Republicans are going to not co-opt them, you know, use them rather than actually address their problem.
You know, you say that snark often is used in political terms, but that it has zero interest in civic virtue.
It's right, exactly. And unlike satire, which is always proposing a better world, you're making fun of this world of social mores or some literary form or something, but behind that critique is a serious idea that there should be a better world, that there should be a better way of doing things. That defines satire, that reforming purpose, whereas what I'm thinking of is just to show yourself as clever and to tear down. And also, it's particularly produced by the anxiety of journalism in a period when it's God knows where, you know, print journalism is going. Mm-hmm. And newspapers and magazines are losing ads every day, and yet as the ads sort of go into all these niches, and the internet, they're not making any money either, most of them. It's very hard to figure out how to monetize all these little niche. And magazines, you know, have websites, and The New Yorker has one too. And we're not sure how to make money out of it. Anyway, that's on the establishment side of the media. Then there are all the kids trying to break in and earn a living at journalism. And one way you try to be noticed, and I suppose this was always true, but it's truer now, is to be snippy, snappy, sarcastic, you know, really nasty, hoping that you frame an insult so memorably it'll spread virally, as they say, through the internet and make you famous. And the joke of that, and is that a lot of the kids, you know, can't afford to live in New York or Los Angeles or Washington at current rates, so they really want to enter the mainstream media that they're attacking. A lot of the time, they're in a bizarrely paradoxical situation.
Yeah, that is an interesting thing, and I've noticed it too. It is interesting. We're going to have to take a quick break. David Demby is my guest. He's the New Yorker film critic, and he's also an author. His latest book, Snark. We'll talk about that more. If you want to talk about it or have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Be sure to catch Art Zine, Columbus's monthly art show, anytime online at wosu.org/artzine. On this month's show, go behind the scenes at Ballet Met's The Nutcracker, see the art of quilts at the newest exhibition at the Rife Gallery, and get to know the artists of soul art from the National Afro-American Museum and Cultural Center. Art Zine gives you a firsthand look at the arts in action in Columbus, online at wosu.org/artzine. 22 degrees in downtown Columbus, a few clouds this morning, sunshine this afternoon, and a high of 28. Clear skies tonight, a low of 15 degrees, sunshine for Wednesday, and a high of 33, and a little warmer on Thursday, sunshine and a high of 37 for Thursday. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is David Denby. He's the New Yorker film critic. I'm sure you've heard of him. He's also an author, and his book, that's what we're talking about today, is his new book, Snark. It's mean, it's personal, and it's ruining our conversation. We have, if you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Tom, you are on the air.
Good morning, Ann.
Good morning.
I'd like to ask your guest if the major dictionaries have accepted the newer use of the word. I have an old American college, and the word is there, and it is, as he has mentioned, a mysterious imaginary animal.
Yeah.
Now, has the newer use been accepted?
Not in American dictionaries, I think, but the Oxford English Dictionary traces the sort of genealogy of the word that I was sort of giving informally, you know, a few minutes ago. So it'll get there. I mean, it seems to be coming into more and more use as to define a certain kind of low humor or ill humor. But you're right. I don't think it's in the American dictionary.
I find that so hard to believe. I mean, we friend each other. I mean, there's all these other words.
All these dreadful words have made it into the dictionary. I know. These non-existent words that just have some currency. You're absolutely right.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom. What you said, who are the worst offenders? You devoted an entire chapter to Maureen Dowd, for example. And often when you talk about the worst offenders, you also say they're often gifted writers.
Oh, well, Maureen Dowd is a very gifted writer. This is a New York Times political columnist for many years. And I thought she was doing a sort of cleaning up her act last winter, not because of my book, but because, which first came out then in hardcover. But I think just because in relation to a more serious time and the fact that it was, that whatever you think of Obama's policies, he's obviously hardworking and sincere guy. I mean, he's not a hypocrite in any way, and he's not lazy like a certain other presidents we could name. So she seems to be cleaning up her act and writing more seriously. My objection to Maureen Dowd is that she seizes only on personality characteristics and manner and affect and never talks about political ideas, never talks about what the point of politics is or a politician. She thinks it's all self-seeking and it's all imposture and it's all vanity. Maybe just because she's scared about the Christmas Day terrorist attack or she's frustrated with the rate of reform or something, that she's gone after, starting to go after Obama in a very snarky way, calling him Spock and Captain Obvious and so on and so forth. It's this ridicule of people's manners rather than what their actual policies are. So my problem with her is that she's an opportunist who has no real political convictions at all, as far as I can see. I have to hasten to say she's verbally extremely talented, and she's read a great deal, and she understands how movies and television sort of colonize the unconscious. I mean, she's hip to a lot of things. She's very talented. So it's a shame to me that she can be devastatingly funny in a serious way. If she would do that, I think she would. It would really be great.
Now, there are some, well, they wouldn't be good snarker. I mean, they would, what you think of as some of the best satirists out there, the people who do it right.
Yeah, well, I think like Stephen Colbert is doing something fairly complicated. Stephen Colbert is a liberal who pretends to be a conservative. He puts on his Bill O'Reilly rubber face mask every night and interviews guests and badgers them with right-wing positions, the purpose of which is to expose what for him is the absurdity of those positions. In other words, he exaggerates it to show what's wrong with it. And it's kind of tough being a guest on his show because you don't want to start getting into furious arguments over with him when he's putting you on. That's irony. That's when you say one thing and mean its opposite. That's pretty sophisticated. And it's sort of irony which shades into satire both together. That's remarkable at a popular level. I mean, for an audience of, you know, a million people or something, whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
or 2 million people, that's pretty high-level stuff. I mean, Jon Stewart, his buddy, can be sort of more broader, sort of semi-slanderous, just, you know, making fun of people's appearance, and it's not quite, I mean, he can be clever too, but it's not quite at that level.
Well, I think the Tucker Carlson exchange, the former CNN talk show host, kind of brought all that to the fore when he said, well, people listen to your show, you know, you're responsible for getting the news to people. And he's like, I'm not a newsman, I'm a comedian.
But actually, if you talk to your kids, you know, your college kids and so on, a lot of them do watch Stewart to get their news, and because some of which he presents straight,
mm-hmm.
so they may not read the newspaper, but they do go to him.
Well, he's often lampooning the media.
Often lampooning the media, yes, as well as but I guess there is a notion behind all his jokes and Colbert too what you'd have to call civic virtue, that the government should not be operating badly, that it should not be lying to us. That kind of thing. That Supreme Court decision should make sense. Behind all the jokes, there is that serious purpose.
We have a definition from my producer, I believe. She said, World College Dictionary defines snark and snarky. Snark is Lewis Carroll's imaginary animal, and snarky is touchy, short-tempered, irritable. At least it's there, but it's not really what you're calling it.
Pretty close.
It's getting at kind of that idea of meanness, that mean-spiritedness. Listeners, 614-292-8513, or you can email us, allsides@wosu.org. And Ray, you're on the air. You take issue somewhat with David Demby.
Right, and actually it's not so much taking issue, but I'd like to point out some hypocrisy. The comment about Sarah Palin's campaign rhetoric about trying to associate Barack Obama with a former member of the SDS from Chicago. If you want to criticize what she said directly, that's all well and good. But to say it's code for something else strikes me as extremely snarky in the context of what you're using it as, because she can't defend whatever label you're willing to place on her words. She can defend her own words. But to challenge her as saying this is code for some other message that she's trying to convey, then she can't defend because she never intended it as such, and frankly, I don't think it was such. And so I just wanted to point out the hypocrisies that I find, especially from the left. I do see it from all sides, but it seems especially from the left, if you want to criticize somebody, just use their words without using, say, well, this is code. And Maureen Dowd did the same thing when she her comment on Joe Wilson was what she heard. She concedes he didn't say it, but she's willing to attribute it because it's inside her mind.
Well, I thought that the Palin thing was part of a whole campaign. It wasn't just that one remark to make Obama seem un-American.
But it was the example you used. If that's your best example, then it seems like a weak point.
Well, it wasn't the only example. It was the foreign-born issue and
pals around with terrorists. I mean, there was, you know, it's not the, you know, the suggestion that what he was doing was some kind of street activity rather than what she was doing in Wasilla as mayor. There was a whole way of denigrating, his activities that seemed to me really unfair. And the point of which was to suggest you can't trust this guy, and to appeal to buried fears of a black man taking over the White House. And I mean, and you see the Republican Party doing it all the time now.
I would disagree with you. I think the palling around with terrorists is a legitimate point, even if you don't see it as a legitimate point. Many people do. I don't see it as code for anything. I don't think she said they have secret meetings. She did say pals around with the terrorists. And many people see that as a legitimate point without being code for anything, and it doesn't have anything to do with his race.
But the pals around with thing she did defend that. And it was reference to him being on a board with the former SDS member
Bill
from
Ayers.
Many.
Yeah, I mean, they had some casual meetings many years earlier. I mean, it wasn't as if they were close friends or close associates or anything like that. It seemed like a pretty random way of trying to get at someone. And to me, in alliance with a lot of other things that were happening in that campaign, a way of evoking unease with someone who was something new on politics and who was black and different from many of the voters. And
I don't think she ever indicated his race was a cause for unease.
We're talking about codes here. We're not talking about – no one's going to directly –
I'm saying using the code, saying – labeling her words as code for some other message is snarking. And that's unfair. She can only defend what she actually said, not what's inside your mind when you hear this. And as far as trying to create unease, I don't know the last time I saw a political campaign that each candidate didn't try to create some level of unease.
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point, Ray. What do you think about the level of discourse now in political campaigns? It comes from both sides. David made that point earlier.
Right, but then he illustrated it by saying that Palin's a victim within McCain's campaign. I find it extremely troublesome on both sides. I tend to see more of it from the left, but that has a large degree with my perspective. David did say that it comes from both sides, but then 90% of the illustrations are coming from Republicans. And no offense, but that's entirely legitimate, but it's clearly a product of your perspective.
Well, I do think, if you wanted to total it up, that Republicans are more ruthless in these events and these campaigns. I don't mean they have a monopoly on it, but I do think it's depressing that people have openly said that the point of their policies is to destroy the Obama presidency without having serious proposals of their own for health care or for economic recovery. We just have to destroy the Obama presidency. And any way is legitimate, and that opens, the gates to all kinds of semi-slander, coded speech, and so on. And to some degree, it's working. I mean, Obama finds himself in a very difficult situation with these enormous problems and an economy that's not recovering very quickly. I think it is working, and I think there is more of it on the Republican side.
You know, to Ray's point, you say in the book that the gossip blogger Perez Hilton has said that you're a snob for calling him a snark.
Oh, well, his site is just awful. I mean, he buys pictures of stars in various states of undress or in embarrassing situations, and then, makes often obscene comments, and I won't even say it on the air, draws things on their faces and so on. And he thinks that that's journalism, which, of course, is nuts. He's essentially a much more vicious version of the battle axes from the 30s and 40s, like Hedda Hopper and Luella O. Parsons, who would do the studio's bidding and, take down a star who was being uppity or something like that. It's much more open now, and the whole celebrity culture is ruled by snark from top to bottom. That's just human nature. And because we give sort of our love to these people, we take some of our self-love away and give it to them because they're beautiful or they're more talented than us. And the minute they slip or fall, we sort of, like the Furies, come down on them and try to destroy them. And there's a kind of gloating attempt to bring them down utterly. It's pretty ugly stuff, and it happens again and again, and we're all part of it, and I don't exclude myself, but that's a totally snark-ruled business, the whole celebrity business from top to bottom.
We have an email from Sue. She says, I am curious if there is a way for your book and ideas to be most useful, or I think maybe she meant more useful, in diminishing the use of snark in our media and culture. How might we begin to call attention nonpartisanly to this type of speech in the media and from our friends and acquaintances? She says, I think we can spot it fairly easily, but what could we say simply that would help us to begin to spread the word that this type of speech is not only not productive, but harmful, and that we would appreciate more constructive discussions?
I believe there's a saying central to Western culture, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. In other words, don't forget there are people at the other end of this. And that's certainly a problem with teachers trying to get kids to stop, you know, destroying each other, which is pretty common, you know, in school, and ganging up into cliques and trying to exclude people who are slightly different. One of the things about Snark that's fascinating is how conservative it is. That is, it enforces social norms a lot of the time. And that's true at the media level also, by the way, that a lot of the kids who are making fun of stuff are in effect unconsciously serving as thugs of the conglomerate.
Yeah, I saw that. I was going to ask you about that. Give an example of what you mean
by
that.
Just putting down some album that doesn't, you know, conform to what the current notion of hip is or what's currently selling. I mean, I don't see these people, you know, standing up for something that's fresh and new and dangerous and difficult in the arts, whether it's movies or anything else. What they're more likely to do is to feast on something that doesn't work. But what you're emailer is talking about, I think, is more personal, right? And at a local level, and I mean, I don't know what answer there is to make except is just imagine what it would like to feel if that happened to you. And there's stuff of people slandering each other locally on websites, you know, someone they don't like or a rival or, you know, college kids, you know, doing kind of this kind of sexual slander. Would hurt a lot if it happened to you. So if you can reflect on that for a second, I mean, it's pretty much the basic lesson of all ethics, right?
I would imagine you get some feedback that can get kind of snarky since you're a film critic for The New Yorker.
But I've been around since 1910, and, you know, I could have, I'm pretty thick-skinned and tough-hided and
hate mail's sort of your stock and trade, huh?
Yeah, and I deal it out, and I should. I don't like writing hatchet jobs, but of course, I can be very tough sometimes, and I just don't let it get to me. The other thing, of course, to do is not read it. And my wife sometimes, you know, Googles and sees what people are saying about my reviews and gives me little bits of it. It's people who are unprotected who seem to me at greatest danger. Let's say you're changing jobs or you're in the middle of a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
That stuff can be very wounding if it gets out there in the web.
Mm-hmm.
And there are law professors who are seriously concerned, including Cass Sunstein, who's in the Obama administration, about the lack of any protections of our privacy on the internet, and we certainly don't want censorship. I think we can all agree with that. We don't want law
mm-hmm.
here. And so the only recourse for someone like me is to talk about style and about ethics, I guess, grace, manners, use whatever word you like, because we don't want censorship. There's a lot of nasty stuff about all of us out there. Don't recommend anyone Google himself.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a mortifying experience, or it can be funny if you can roll with a punch.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're going to take a quick break. My guest is David Denby. He's the New Yorker film critic, and we're going to talk about films when we return.
All right.
All right. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, with Congress back in session, we discuss what's in the House and Senate health care bills and consider what a compromise bill might look like with Jonathan Cohn, senior editor of The New Republic, where he writes a health care blog called The Treatment. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Get the latest information from WOSU the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Go to WOSU.org/email to sign up for one of WOSU's e-newsletters. And WOSU Public Media presents the Columbus Metropolitan Club's weekly forum. Tomorrow, join in a discussion of climate change as an approaching storm for national security. Visit ColumbusMetroClub.org to register. 22 degrees in downtown Columbus, a few clouds this morning, some sunshine this afternoon, a high of 28. Skies clear tonight, a low of 15 degrees, sunshine for Wednesday and a high of 33. And even warmer for Thursday, sunny and a high of 37. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 and VR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is David Denby. He is the New Yorker film critic. We were talking about his book. It was just released in paperback, Snark. Now let's talk about movies. It is Oscar time.
So it is.
What does that mean? What's going on right now?
Well, there's no way of avoiding Avatar, which I think is a great new experience. I'm not much of a science fiction person, and I don't look for technological solutions to what's wrong with American movies. But I have to say that I was pretty much overwhelmed when I saw it, and very excited. And what I remember of 3D from a kid is that stuff would float out at you, explode, right? And someone would scream in the theater. Or someone would shoot a cannon in your face. In this case, you're going into space, and it's this totally made-up world that Cameron has done, and it's beautiful, filled with all sorts of fascinating physical creatures, and it's as much vertical as horizontal, so it's a sort of up as well as in, but you're constantly going into space. And the part of the point of this society of the Na'vi, who are these 9-foot blue creatures, is that they're all connected to nature. They're all connected to each other. They're all connected to creatures. There are sort of like neural underground connections. It's not just a spiritual, mystical idea. It's an actual connection. And that meaning is reinforced by the way Cameron has created this thing, which is you're constantly going into space, so you seem to be making connections among different things physically. That is one terrific. We're talking about 3D here, of course, not 2D. See it in 3D. I'm not sure about seeing it in IMAX. I didn't see it that way, but people say there's so much information on the screen you can get a headache.
It's a little overwhelming.
It's a little too much information. So the story, which is coming back to politics again, driving right-wing cultural commentators crazy because it's about contractors and industrial predators who are disrupting an Aboriginal society in search of raw materials that can be used for energy. A lot of people are taking it as an attack on the Bush administration. Shock and awe is even a word that's used by the invaders, they're complaining about it politically. I think most of us are not looking at it that way. We're looking at it as this wondrous physical and sensuous experience.
Well, and I mean, in any science fiction, usually is another way of looking at political philosophy
at our own society,
right,
through a kind of weird lens.
I mean, the Alien series was all about that.
You're right.
And
so it's an element, certainly. Okay, it's an element certainly in the movie, but I don't think that should be the principal way anyone experiences this. I mean, a movie is not just some ideological meaning that you can pull out of it, right? Or is it some intellectual structure you can impose on it? It's a complete experience, physical experience, sensuous experience, if it's really working. And that's what this does.
So what else works?
Well, there was a little war movie that won all the critics' awards, literally all of them, The Hurt Locker, made by a woman, Catherine Bigelow, that opened in June. And I'm sorry to say, despite all our critical efforts, not many people saw it. And this is not a political movie. It's about the guys who defused the bombs in Baghdad. I mean, it's political only by sort of implication, but certainly not directly. And it is thrilling and hair-raising and tells you a lot about Americans in Iraq. It's set in 2004. That's definitely going to be nominated for Best Picture. There are now 10 nominees, you know, in Best Picture rather than the usual 5.
Why is that?
They wanted to get too many of the smaller specialty division films like Brokeback Mountain and Sideways, and we're getting nominations and not the things that they were spending $200 million making. So I think they wanted to
at least get a nomination out there.
Yeah, and TV attendance for the Oscars show was falling off because those were smaller films. A lot of people hadn't seen them. So I think they wanted to enlarge the number of nominees to bring in some of those larger pictures and also a larger audience for the Oscar broadcast.
So Hurt Locker.
Yes, Up in the Air with George Clooney and Vera Farmiga, which is about a guy who goes around firing people. It's an odd project in some ways because it's based on a novel written in 2001. In 2001, if you were fired, you could get another job.
You could get a severance package.
Yeah, not only that, but you could find another job somewhere.
Yeah.
And the screenplay was probably written about 2 years ago, so we were entering into this awful recession. So they added, here's this sort of snazzy, debonair stuff going on between Clooney and Vera Farmiga, who are two high flyers who have a love affair and sort of airport hotels, just meet on the road, as it were. They added all this stuff with footage of real people who have been fired. There are three actors, three ringers who are actors, professional actors. All the rest are real people who were actually fired in the last year. And that stuff, in relation to this sort of snazzy fiction that you're watching about a love affair, makes me kind of uneasy. I mean, it doesn't seem to me that the two parts of the movie really hang together. But what's good about it is very good. And Clooney is terrific, and Vera Farmiga is terrific, and it's a lot of fun. They're bantering, and all the sort of dirty sexual talk is great fun, in the way that Bogart and Bacall, you know, 60 years ago, bantering with each other was great fun. So that's another one that will certainly be nominated.
You know, Vera Farmiga, I just wanted to ask about her. What else has she done? She was she brought a very subtle touch to it.
She's of Ukrainian descent. She grew up in New Jersey. She's in her late 30s. She's sort of got a slow start. She has a real streak of humor that she brings to everything, and I think she may go a long way. I mean, we'll see if she gets the roles, you know, that she deserves. I know that everyone wants to work with her now because this is obviously a very intelligent woman and a great actress. So, you know, you go, girl.
She looks like she could sort of be sort of chameleon-like and take on a lot of different projects.
Yes, she could play beautiful. She could play ugly. She could play nasty. She could play sweet and gentle. I think she has a wide range. Look, there's nothing wrong with acting in American movies. The acting is at very high level.
It's really underrated.
There's a lot of other problems. But the acting, I mean, Jeremy Renner, who's not terribly well-known, who is the chief bomb diffuser in this movie I mentioned earlier, The Hurt Locker, is a tremendous actor. There's a wonderful Irish actor, of Irish-German descent named Michael Fassbender. He was in Inglourious Bastards, he's in a new British movie called Fish Tank. He's, to me, a charismatic actor who could be a great star. We'll see. You know, it takes a lot of luck. So, I mean, there are good people all over the place. It's the commercial structure of the industry, though, doesn't always, you know, encourage people to do their best efforts.
What else is out there that caught your eye this year that you like?
Well, I don't know. There's the German film White Ribbon, which is slowly making its way around the country, and it's by actually Austrian guy Michael Haneke. And it's set in a German town in northern Germany, Prussian Germany, at the eve of the First World War. And it's black and white, very cool, very controlled, and underneath this rather severe, forbidding religious surface in this town, these strange criminal acts are going on. And you don't know who's committing them. There's an enormous amount of mystery about it. And it's meant to suggest that the roots of Nazism 20 years later were there and family structure and this extremely punitive way of dealing with children, physical, corporal punishment, and in a generalized hypocrisy. It's a very powerful. It's not the most likable movie in the world, I must say. It's cold, but it is brilliant, and it's the most extraordinary use of black and white that I've seen in a decade. So that's slowly making its way around the country. The White Ribbon. Certainly good.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Denby. We were talking about his book. It's just been released in paperback, Snark. But he is also the New Yorker film critic, and we're talking about films now during Oscar season. How important is it to the Oscars that there is that television audience out there now? I mean, isn't the internet kind of picking up some of that slack?
Yeah, but the revenue from those ads, you know, it used to be the single most, I guess that and the Super Bowl,
yeah,
the most important TV events of the year, and it's been falling off in recent years, and, you know, the networks are unhappy, and the advertisers are unhappy, and so on. So it's certainly something the Academy thinks about, keeping the size of that audience up. And I think, as we were saying, that's one of the main reasons for expanding the Best Picture category. Whether it works or not, we'll see.
Yeah. Is this the first time they've done it?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's the first time they've had 10 nominees, although there are 5 in the other craft, you know, Best Actor and Best Actress, and so on. I think Meryl Streep will certainly get some action for Julia and Julia, mm-hmm, and deservedly so. And we mentioned Vera Farmiga. I guess that's a supporting performance. And Woody Harrelson in another film that not many people have seen called The Messenger. He's there with a brilliant young actor named Ben Foster, and it's their army lifers, and it's their job to Woody Harrelson's an army lifer, and Foster's just come back from Iraq, and it's their job to bring the bad news to families who have lost someone. And mm-hmm, I know that sounds like an impossibly grim subject, but it's about them as well, and how this duty plays out in their lives. And it's marvelously written and acted, and I hope people will see it.
I'm getting ready to watch that and also interview, I think, one of the writers on that movie. It kind of reminded me of that HBO film that Kevin Bacon did.
And it's directed by Owen Moverman, who's an Israeli who never directed before, but he did spend 4 years in the Army. I don't know if he performed these kind of death duties, but he knows what Army guys are like. And I would say this is the best portrait of what, you know, being inside the Army that we've had since way back, since mm-hmm, maybe From Here to Eternity in the early 50s. Or Clint Eastwood's movie Heartbreak Ridge, which gave you a kind of inside look. He was a Marine, actually. Mm-hmm. Of what that kind of totally male life is like. Strong stuff.
It's David Demby. He's a New Yorker film critic. If you would like to speak with him, ask a question, make a comment, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And, John, you're on the air. You want to talk about Peter Bogdanovich?
Yes, a former film writer who turned director, I guess he got frustrated and wanted to make his own films, Peter Bogdanovich is going to be in Columbus later this week for a showing of a couple of his films, and he's going to be talking afterwards. And what I was wondering was, is there a question that I'd like a polite question that I could ask Peter Bogdanovich at the screening on Saturday?
Yeah, there is that problem, isn't there? Because he started so well with The Last Picture Show and other very nice movies in the early 70s, mm-hmm, and he got sort of grandiose and full of himself and married Sybil Shepherd, and that went kaflooey. And he sort of got overblown and ran out of gas to the point where nobody wanted to fund him anymore. He's gone back to film writing and interviewing. He's a first-rate film historian, and he interviewed all the greats before they died, like John Ford and so on, and Hitchcock and Hawks. This was when he was really young, in his 20s.
And his book on Orson Welles is absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, and Welles, he was close to Welles. You might ask him about Welles and about the tragedy of Welles's career and whether any of these fragmented pieces of that Welles worked on will ever come out in more complete form. I would like to know that. I mean, because he started a number of projects and then ran out of money on them or ran away from them. I mean, Welles is a complicated, perverse guy himself.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened to those? He's one of the people who sort of keeps American film history going, Peter Bogdanovich. So, I mean, he continues to be very, very useful. I'm sorry that his directing career blew up the way it did, because I thought he started fabulously with The Last Picture Show. I mean, that has to be one of the great debuts in the history of directing. And actually, was it the first film or was it the second? It was the second, but it was early, very, very early.
The first film is actually a part of what's being shown this weekend. Is it The Shadows, I think it is?
No, I'm forgetting the name too. It's with Boris Karloff, and it's a Target, and it's a kind of play on Hollywood conventions and horror movies and so on. And then came The Last Picture Show with Jeff Bridges and Timothy Bottoms and Sybil Shepherd. It's called Portrait of Small Town Life from the Larry McMurtry novel in Texas in the early 70s.
Any of your listeners who might be interested, the Wexner Center is sponsoring I think three or four of his films this weekend, and his Saturday he's introducing
Is it What's Up, Doc?
What's Up, Doc? Yeah.
That was an attempt to do a kind of modern screwball comedy. It's not as good as the classics from the 30s, but I'd certainly like to see it again. I bet it's better than a lot of stuff coming out now.
Okay, John, thanks for your call.
Thank you very much.
You know, like Peter Bogdanovich, are there any others out there that you wish could come back?
Well, the most obvious would be Francis Ford Coppola. He's in his 70s now, and he's working. I mean, I think the last couple of films he's made have been pretty boring, and I don't know what happened to him. He sort of had this extraordinary ability to tell emotionally complex stories at the time of Godfather 1 and 2 and The Conversation, and then some of the others that he made after that. He also was sort of overtaken by grandiosity. I mean, he was, you know, starting his own studio. He was going to take over the island of Belize.
He was a winery.
He still has the winery. And makes not bad wines, which you can buy, and there's a restaurant in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. I don't mean that he's impoverished or anything like that, but I think he never quite recovered from Apocalypse Now, that, you know, a ruinously expensive and difficult film made about the Vietnam War in 1979, and that's 30 years ago. Some of that movie is absolutely masterful. It's a trip up the river. It's all based on Conrad's Heart of Darkness with Martin Sheen going to eliminate Marlon Brando's general has gone mad. The trip up river is as great as anything he's ever done, I think. And you can see that now in a longer restored version on DVD, where he added some sequences to that part of the movie. The end was what was sort of it all fell apart for him. I mean, he made a few good movies after that, but I would love to see him come back.
So what is your pick?
For Oscar?
Yes.
I think Avatar, you know, which is on its way to being the most highest box office movie of all time. And you have to look at that figure a little critically because ticket prices are higher. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Titanic was 12 years ago, and the average ticket price is much lower. Also, 3D raises the ticket price. But
was the Titanic the...
That's the number one.
Oh, so he's outdoing himself.
The worldwide theatrical gross, and we're not talking about cable sales here or DVDs, on Titanic was $1.8 billion. As of last weekend, after 3 weeks, Avatar was already up to $1.3 billion worldwide. Mm-hmm. Two-thirds of it is overseas. It opened everywhere simultaneously because they wanted to defeat piracy by getting the thing in theaters. Mm-hmm. So I think that will probably win because it is very accomplished. I think it's a much better movie than Titanic, which won whatever it won, 8 Oscars.
I didn't see it until I...
Yeah.
You know what, David, we have to take off now. We're running out of time.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, don't apologize. It's been a lot of fun to have you on. David Demby, he is the New Yorker film critic, and he's an author of Snark. It just came out in paperback. Thanks again. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820 NPR News.